T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Want to put your baseball skills to the test? Then get ready to show your stuff with MLB Pitch, Hit, and Run. The official youth skills competition of Major League Baseball. Sign up for free for a chance to play your way to the Pitch, Hit, and Run finals at the 2024 World Series. Visit pitchhitrun.com today.
Rajah Bell knows an awful lot about slapping the floor and playing defense. And if the Warriors are going to be anything come play-in tournament time, they're going to have to do that and stay hot Steph Curry. To talk about the Suns in town, we're very happy to say hello to Rajah Bell. Joining us here, Damon Bruce and Ray Ratto. Rajah, thank you for joining us today. I know you're doing that Real Ones NBA podcast for The Ringer with Logan Murdoch, who obviously spends a lot of time right here in the Bay Area backyard. So it's great to have you on here today. Thank you so much.
Hey, thanks for having me, fellas. Yeah, Logan is a proud Bay Area native, and I have to hear about it way too much for my taste. But he's a good dude, and I'm happy to be doing it. Thanks for having me on.
If this helps at all, you can backhand him. I've worked with him. You just bring across a quick right hand, he'll quiet down.
There you go. That's very nice. It's a good way to handle things, certainly in the workplace.
I'm glad I got the green light. I appreciate it.
Look at it this way. Rajah might be able to do it because this guy was nasty when he was out there playing basketball. That is for sure. We have Draymond Green, who obviously is a Swiss Army knife that is hard to compare to any other guy that really played. Now, maybe the position of center had to regress a little bit, not quite in the lands of Hakeem Olajuwon and Patrick Ewing anymore. But as the center regressed to more positionless basketball, Draymond Green, really, Rajah, it looks like he is one of those rare 1 through 5 he can defend at all guys. And it's not overhype. It's not oversell. I don't know how many guys can really say, I defend all 5 positions at an elite level. I know Rudy Gobert is good. I know he's popping out on the perimeter better than ever. I know Capella's doing the same. But Draymond is just so different.
Yeah, he is the only guy that I can think of off the top that can really guard 1 through 5. I mean, those guys will go out there, and in today's NBA, you know, there are more switches than ever. I mean, they switch 90% of the time. So they're asked to be out on the perimeter, but they don't effectively really lock down or have the capability of locking down a one. If you put him on him for, you know, 50 to 60% of the game, that's, they're going to get, you know, exposed. And that's not really a knock on them. Those guys are huge. They're long. They're not, you know, used to naturally being in space. But Draymond is, and Draymond, I think, could effectively guard a one. You know, I'm not saying that he's locking any of them down like the Dame Lillards over the course of an entire night, but I think he could do an effective job on a one most of the night if you put him on him. So I would tend to agree with you. I mean, he's a very interesting player. He fills, you know, a lot of stat sheet, a lot of boxes for teams. And, you know, the beauty of a Draymond for a guy like me, it isn't necessarily what he does on the stat sheet or who he can guard. It's what he means to the team, to the fabric of the organization, to the culture that you're developing in a locker room. And those type of things you can't really put a price tag or a statistic on. It's you know, the character type of stuff that keeps guys understanding what a franchise is about and keeps them, you know, dedicated day in and day out to the goal at hand, which is to win championships. Someone has to drive that culture. I know Steph and Clay do it as well, but Draymond's a huge part of that.
So if you're coaching just a league average team, you know, some good players, you know, enough to be a playoff team, how do you negate all the things that Green does? How do you sort of go at him and try to find the weaknesses that allow you to make him at least sort of a zero-sum player as opposed to the guy who changes so much on a night-to-night basis?
It's a really good question. I'm probably not the best person to answer. That's why I'm not an NBA head coach. But I'll give it a shot. What I would do to Draymond offensively at least. And it's easier said than done. This is all in a vacuum, right? This would be just purely game plan on paper would be, you know, to try to make him score the ball. Like, I would try to, the best of my ability, cut off any outlets he had to shooters, stay home, you know, double Steph given any opportunity, and then completely deny the ball back to him. Again, much easier said than done. And even the peripheral players there, you know, I wouldn't give those guys the opportunities to catch and shoot off of Draymond's penetration. I challenge him to continue to finish and, you know, see if he could theoretically get 45, you know, 46 or something like that. You know, the Sun, when I played with the Suns, the Mavericks and the Spurs were two teams we struggled with in playoffs. They took that approach to Amari and Steve. They said, look, we know you guys could both wind up with 35, but we trust that if we cut off Sean Marion, and if we cut off Raja's 10 to 15, and we cut off Boris's 15 to 17, and we cut off Barbosa's 15, that we'll beat you. And it did. It played itself out over the course of those series. So that's the way I would approach Draymond, at least defensively, because he's so good at facilitating, and he's always creating havoc. You know, on the defensive end, you know, I tend to think that, you know, the one way he could be exposed, because he plays so many guys so well, is with a real true big. And no one really wants to do that. No one has the time to come down and anchor, you know, a big to the block and just, you know, use the mismatch over and over and over. Aesthetically, it's not what people want to see. It's not the way guys are trained to play the game. But that's about all I could really think of, because, you know, anywhere on the perimeter, he's pretty good, and pick and roll, he's pretty good. He can guard your man up. But if you had a Joel Embiid type of guy who's just a bully down there on the block and is really well-versed in back to the basket, footwork, and finishing, that's what I would try to do to him if I had that at my disposal. I'd try to make, you know, that undersized five really pay with a old-school beat-em-up, I can get you 40 on this block type of player, and in the process I'm going to get you in foul trouble, and now you're on the bench.
Again, I don't know how perfect to defend all positions Draymond would have been in the 80s, but the type of basketball we're playing right now, he is definitely a breed unto himself. Raja Bell, two-time all-defensive member, joining us here on 95.7 The Game. And as a guy, look, we all know that this is a score first, second, and third league. As a guy who was so dedicated to the craft of playing elite-level defense, I'm guessing it was up to you to be the coach on the floor in certain moments and times. How hard is it to be the guy to convince offensive-minded NBA players to do more defensively? Because I'm guessing that was part of your job.
Yeah, it was. It was part of my job. You know, it's difficult. I mean, everyone loves to play offense. It's what you do in pickup games. It's what you grow up doing. And you know, sometimes, you know, defense is a hard sell to guys. There were teams I played on where I had more success at it than others. Those teams tended to be more successful. But I think when you get on those successful rosters, you know, everyone's thought process is aligned. Typically, people's windows of opportunity are to some degree aligned. And so the sell is easier because, you know, it's an integral part of what you're doing. Every team that's won a championship in the last, I don't know, 10, 15 years that I can remember has been a top 10 team defensively. And, you know, and selling that is just part of what you have to do to be in that conversation. So, you know, you can't be afraid if you're talking about a guy like Draymond or even myself, like to play that role, you can't be afraid of the confrontation. The confrontation is going to be organic when you're that guy. Like, you're going to have guys that don't want to do it, guys that think they're too nice to play, you know, defense and just don't understand how, you know, important it is to execute that game plan as much as you can. Sure, we're going to make mistakes, but we got to hold each other accountable when we do and try to execute it to the highest percentage we can. And if you're going to be the guy that does that, you know, I was, Draymond is, there are going to be confrontations, but you can't be afraid of it. You got to stick to your guns. And then afterwards, you know, you go find that teammate and whoever it was that may have had a beef, and you explain, look, this, your job is to score 30. Mine is to anchor this and make sure we're on the same page with that. And so I respect you and yours. You know, hopefully you can respect me and mine, because they all come from the same place, which is trying to win some games.
Speaking specifically of Phoenix, this is probably the best defensive team they've had in some years. And because their MO was, well, we'll just score, we'll worry about defense if we have to. Who gets the most credit for changing that mindset? Is it Monty Williams? Is it Chris Paul? Is it something more organic? What made Phoenix view basketball differently this year?
Yeah, I think it's exactly who you said it was. I think, you know, it starts with Monty, and what he preaches in training camp and the mantra that they're going to have through the season, like the culture he's trying to develop. But, you know, sometimes you have to have that guy that everybody respects, that guy that everyone knows his resume, in lockstep with you, preaching and talking the same thing you're talking when you're not around. So on the buses, in the locker rooms, when we're all sitting in the cold tub, you know, when we're out to dinner, you know, the conversation has to reflect what you were talking about as the head coach earlier in the day. So I think the two of them have worked well together. I also throw some credit at my man James Jones, who's doing a great job there in kind of finding pieces. I think the Jay Crowder piece is a really, really good piece to that defensive, gritty type of culture that you're trying to establish with your team. You know, I even think that the Torrey Craig piece was a really nice piece for that. So I think it starts with the two, but you got to give James some credit for finding pieces along the way that helped develop that. And then, the young kid from Villanova, I'm drawing a blank on his name right now. I don't know why I hate to do that. But
Bridges?
Mikal Bridges is an excellent defender. Like, they've got nice pieces, but it certainly starts at the top with your best player or your 1A or 1B and then your coach.
Raja Bell joining us here. Suns in town taking on the Warriors tonight. What do you think of the play-in, by the way? Are you into it, not into it? Did you think it was a good idea, change your mind, and come back to it? How do you feel?
Yeah, I'm cool with it. I've always saw the NBA as the league that wasn't afraid to tinker around the edges and step outside and look at things from a different perspective and see if they could make it more exciting. And so I appreciated it when they put it in. I hear guys beefing about it, but quite frankly, I didn't hear too many people beefing about it when they weren't in that situation the year before, at least the guys I've heard of recently. So for as a fan just sitting back watching now, I'm tuning into games and watching them, and they've got a level of playoff intensity that I enjoy. And, I don't watch every game throughout the season because they don't have that. And I'll tune in now because these games, there's something – on the line, guys are invested, and you can see it. You can feel that intensity if you played and you know how to, like, identify it. Those aren't regular, like, December games. Like, these are heated exchanges with something on the line, and I appreciate it.
Well, so you played – I'm looking at your career here. You played through your age 35 season, and Chris Paul is in his age 35 season right now. How harder was it for you and your body – to get up to play an NBA game in your last year? And is Chris Paul like an alien or a freak of nature? How's that happening?
Yeah, well, I got to give him a lot of credit. I mean, at 35, I had certainly lost a step. I could see things and couldn't get to them the way I thought I could. I was losing a little bit of lift on my jump shot, but I think I could have still been serviceable. The end of my career kind of played out in a weird way, but I think these guys do such a great job, like Chris included, in really taking care of their bodies in a way that I didn't really understand when I played, really fueling it the way it needs to be fueled and spending and committing the resources to the recovery and the injury prevention and stuff like that. So,
do you think it's a State Farm insurance and the injury prevention? Is that what it really is?
right. They're just doing great things with the body. And so he's remarkable. What, able to do that at 35 and still be an MVP candidate. Like, I mean, you just got to give him all the credit in the world. But generally speaking, you know, these guys, Tom Brady outside the world of basketball, like, these guys really know how to dial in and take care of that body and extending careers.
Another guy who's got a lot of miles on him is Russell Westbrook, who has sort of been both much reviled and much praised just in the course of this year. What do you make of him on Washington at this point? Is he jaw-droppingly great? Is he infuriating? Where does he fit?
So for me, and I know he can be polarizing, you know, as a basketball player, I am a Russ fan. As a guy who played with his heart on his sleeve and didn't know any other way to do it, I'll start there. I just appreciate the fact that I know what I'm getting from a competitive level from him every single night. You would think that's something you could count on every night with everybody, but you can't. So that's where it starts. I would then say, as a player who, you know, was a pretty good high school player, averaged, 29 a game, would have 40 and 20 rebound games. I never had a triple-double because it was really hard to fill that third stat with a double-figure, you know, night. And so I never had one in the pros, and I never had one in college. It's really, really hard to do that. And so I think he's fantastic. I understand that analytically speaking, people are going to tell me, hey, their win share is better when he's not on the floor. I would throw back at you, like, the percentage of games that are won when he is actually triple-doubling. I mean, it's super high win percentage. So he plays a certain way. It doesn't necessarily fit the eye test for the way the game is played today. But I can still appreciate it and tell you that it's really remarkable what he's doing if he doesn't shoot threes. Like, he doesn't make threes. I'm okay with that. He's high volume. I play with Allen Iverson. That doesn't bother me. Volume's not an issue for me personally, you know? So I am a Russ fan. I think it's remarkable. I truly believe that you're not going to see anyone break this record. It's just too hard to do. That's why it lasted for as long as it did. And I think people should, to some degree, enjoy what they're watching instead of, you know, bashing the man. And what he's done with Bradley Beal, you see that roster that they're playing with? No disrespect. I tuned into the game last night. The man had him in a one-point game with Atlanta. Bradley Beal didn't even play. And I looked around. I was like, Ish Smith, Andres Bertans, like, their names. But he's willing them to an opportunity to win. I think his teammates appreciate him. I know his coaches appreciate him. I certainly do. And I think everyone should. Like, stop knocking him. Appreciate it, because it's going to be gone before you know it.
Rajah Bell here on 95.7 The Game. You just brought up the fact that you were teammates with Allen Iverson. We just, you know, had the anniversary of his We Talking About Practice soundbite, which obviously we heard so much about. What I didn't know is that he was actually wrestling with the death of a close friend at that time. And I look, knowing that now, I always feel like that soundbite is now being played kind of out of context. Could you take us to that day that still echoes throughout NBA media? And did you realize that, I mean, one of Iverson's all-time memorable moments had just happened? When did you hear about the practice rant? Because you might have been at that practice.
Oh, I was there. I was in the building. I was downstairs in the locker room as Chuck did his press conference or press media availability upstairs. We were at Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine is where we practiced at the time, and we watched it live. And I didn't think much of it. I really didn't. It was just kind of Chuck being Chuck. If you knew him, that's just who he was. And then obviously it's a clip that's lived to some degree in infamy for him for a long time. But, you know, what I also knew about Chuck was it's not a fluke what he did for all those years, having been on the court with him and seeing that he worked. Now, work comes in all shapes and sizes. It comes at all different times of the day. Like, no, maybe he didn't come to practice on time every day, you know? And maybe he wasn't as concerned with the effort in practice as he was in the game. But the point was, he was working on his game at times where people weren't watching it. He was doing the type of things to allow him to be an MVP that year, and that wasn't really appreciated. Plus, like Russell Westbrook, he was the ultimate warrior. I'm 6 foot in Timberlands and 165 pounds soaking wet, with two bricks in his pocket, and he was doing that in a day and age where you had multiple seven-footers on the floor for each team. It's remarkable what type of warrior he was, and I think, you know, it's a shame that that's the soundbite that people want to hold on to, but Chuck is an all-time favorite of mine, again, because he's just a beast.
He's one of my all-time favorites, too. I worshipped at the altar of Georgetown Hoya basketball when I was a kid, so I was a huge fan of Iverson, and I'm glad that you shared all those memories in that story. You were teammates with Steph Curry for one game. One game. Did you realize in the 23 minutes you were out on that court that you were playing with one of the greatest basketball? Of course you didn't. Nobody saw this coming. What was your impression of Curry when you met him, and can you believe what he has become?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I came from Charlotte, and his dad, Dell, was like on the broadcast there. So I watched him at Davidson, and I'd ask Dell about him a lot, you know, and we'd have these conversations. Dell was a good dude. I was into golf. They were clearly into golf. And so I knew him through his dad before I got to Golden State. In that game, I had no idea. But I moved out after I had my wrist surgery that year. I went back home after that game, had wrist surgery, and I came back out to the Bay. And I got to be in practices. I got to be around him. I got to be at the games on the bench. There were things that he did in flashes as a rookie where you were, you knew you were watching something different. Now, as a rookie, he wasn't capturing that like every minute of every game. Like he wasn't, hadn't matured into that yet. But I knew that there was something there. I couldn't tell you that he would have revolutionized the game and been what he is today. But you knew that he was better than people even gave him credit for coming out of Davidson, which was, you know, he lit the world on fire at Davidson. But you could see him doing things and making NBA players look silly where you were like, okay, yeah, this is different.
This has been an awesome interview. You've been fantastic. You've shared so much with us. I'm going to push it as far as I can go.
You're good, man. I'm having a good time. What's up?
You're the man who clotheslined Kobe Bryant, for goodness sakes. How would you defend Steph Curry?
How would I defend?
Would you clothesline him?
Would you clothesline Steph Curry?
Yeah, well, listen, I actually tried. I think the first time I played against him, I had signed with Utah. I think I tried to bully him a little bit. I pushed him and shoved him. It didn't work, though. So I had to flip into some other, you know, strategy midstream. I really don't know what you would do with Steph because, you know, unlike some of these guards that are really dancing on the ball so much, I could employ a strategy for that. Steph isn't on the ball that much anymore. Now he'll cook you if he's on the ball, but you know, so much of what they do is Steph, you know, seeing if he can get one off and moving the ball, and then a la Reggie and Rip Hamilton and Ray Allen, he's just perpetual motion after that. And so as a defender, you're only really as good as the help you get or the communication on the screen. Like there was a miscommunication. I stayed with the big didn't stay with Steph, boom, shots in the air. Or he didn't show hard enough shots. So I don't know how you would guard him. It's impossible. All I would say is if they ever brought a secondary defender to Steph Curry and it was organic, I would just trap him. Especially, no disrespect to the team he's on now, but without Clay and KD, I would just have to roll the dice that the other Warriors were going to beat me. And anytime a secondary defender came into the mix, I would trap the hell out of him, make him pass it, and then I'd do my damnedest to kind of deny him the ball back.
Do you like, I mean, it's tough to ask you this because we don't even know who the matchup is going to be, but would you give the Warriors a puncher's chance in any playoff scenario? We're not talking about the play-in. Assuming that they make it in the playoffs, would you give them a puncher's chance against either Utah or Phoenix?
Oh, that's tough. That's tough because I tell you they could win a playoff game because with Steph and what they're doing out there and Draymond, I think, you know, they're in a one-game scenario. It's tough for me over seven. My answer is probably not. I'm not a puncher's chance. I give them a chance because you still have one of the best players on the planet and to you guys' point, one of the best fives in the game. Seven games is a long series. Four is a lot of games to win. And I just don't know how much real experience they have beyond that. And playoffs require you to have some seasoning. They require you to have been in the wars and kind of learn through trial and error and having your heart broken and figuring it out. And I don't know that there's enough of that surrounding those two. If you made me pick a team that they could have a shot against, it would probably be Phoenix. But I don't really think so. I hate that I have to say that on a Bay Area station.
No. Hey, look, we want you here because you're going to tell us what you really think. That's what makes you a valuable conversation. And I tell you, Logan Murdoch's got a hell of a co-host. This was fantastic. Please, promote the podcast. What are you guys cooking up next and when you dropping it?
Yeah, man, we're called the Real Ones Pod. We come out Mondays and Thursdays. We're on the Ringer Network, Spotify. You can get us wherever you get your podcast. But Logan is super cool, man. I've learned a lot working with him, a lot about the Bay Area working with him. And we just have a good time. We're on there. We're not a traditional, like, X and O analytical pod. We just like to talk and have a good time, tell stories, and chop it up. So check us out.
It's a great podcast. I have heard it, and you are great at it. Thank you so much, Raja Bell, for joining us today. This was awesome.
Appreciate it, guys.
Thanks.
And tell Logan we tolerated him.
Fair enough.
There you go.